This is White Scar's Team Up.
Going back a little bit, thinking about your experience with Buck and Francisco, honestly, if I had to pick between the two of them, the thing about Mayor Buck is that he is a completely reprehensible person, but in theory, he's also a reprehensible person that doesn't necessarily have a lot of power. When they're having that conversation in New Athens, he is hoping for the RSA to give him the respect and the power that really he doesn't really seem to get. It's a very E.B. Farnham vibe that yes. comes across to him. So he can be very, in theory, what he believes is charming and obsequious, but you just listen to him talk for 30 seconds and you find out exactly just what kind of person he is.
Yeah.
And he doesn't even have to say any of the really hard-biting slurs or anything like that in order to for you to get that sense of him. It's the first one of the first words we hear come out of his mouth. I'm doing it now too. One of the first words we hear coming out of his mouth is mulatto. And yeah. Oh my god, that's a fucking loaded word right there.
Yeah.
It's like yeah. And tone setter. Okay.
But the fact that he's a weak person makes him slightly less dangerous than Francisco, who is the king of emotional manipulation and gaslighting.
Yeah.
And that to me is the far more dangerous thing.
Yeah.
And it's a Definitely. Difference of the world they inhabit, or at least the world that they affect, at least how the reader or listener experiences them, because with Buck, he's kind of almost incidental, even though conceptually, like, you know, there's no one else left who will necessarily challenge him on his authority. And so that's not the like ideal circumstances. He could, you know, he seems relatively harmless when confronted by people who actually give a damn.
Yeah.
But, you know, conceptually, he could be a problem to a number of people. And Francisco is, you know, a piece of shit, but he's sort of a piece of shit to a small number of people. But in Miguel's world, he is such a major factor.
Yeah.
He influences so much. He is responsible for so much. And he determines all of this. And I think it just goes to show that when you get into the headspace of a character as much as you do with Miguel, that this one person that means so much to them represents the much bigger sort of force of malevolence than some incidental asshole who thinks he's
right.
king of his little patch.
Yeah.
The very next episode we have on the docket to record involves the first revelation of Francisco Delgado to the audience of Tiger's Eye. And while we'll get into it a lot more during the actual episode, the line that I can't help but think of comes from one of the final chapters of Uncivil Outlaw. In the eyes of a child, our parents are pretty much God. That says the most about why Miguel's father hits below the belt for the audience. You see in him the nature of the practiced abuser, the one who can seem completely charming to anybody else and can convince other people to, you know, that he's a good guy that you want to do stuff with, and can shut that off like on a fucking switch and reveal the true self to their prey, so to speak.
Yeah, that's like the antithesis of, you know, me every day. It's like, oh, you're not so much, you know, it's like, oh, it's a different, it's like, no, this is about his not me as I would like to be. It's like, oh God, you want me to do what? Like,
and on top of that, at the very least, as far as Buck is concerned, we can imagine him getting his comeuppance when we find out at the end of Steamheart that Mary Sampson was like, wait a second, and then just turned back around with all of her people and kicked Buck out on his ass.
Right.
The right. only resolution we get with Francisco was, someone else's headcanon that, you know, after that final scene in Steamheart, that Rao secretly went back there and just bit his head off.
Yeah.
I love that.
Let's play Evisceration.
Don't, like, be careful as you, and let's play Operation. Be careful taking the parts out. Oh, whoops, I keep making.
Oh, no, it happened again.
Oh, this is your spleen. Did you need that?
I was literally going to say spleen, but, you know, all right, you got me. You beat me to it.
18th time's the charm. But I always bring this up. It's the little epilogues that were on again, off again for Alex. And for that particular episode in Steamheart, it just ends with something that stays with me, because I haven't really seen any author do this, where they will just say, you can make up any ending you want for Francisco, as just this confirmation we're done with him, which is almost the worst fate of all, because first of all, in this world of fiction where everything is just what the author shows, what the author says about these characters, to say we will speak no more of this person really does just eliminate them.
Yeah.
But it also is the worst fate because it's like, oh, it's up to us. We will not be kind.
Yes.
All right. We do have some topics on our list that are not speaking about the complicated villains of New Century. But since 5 million years ago, you brought up the character of Johann Krieger, let's go back to him for a moment. So that was an incredible revelation there, in that the way that you managed to make Krieger sympathetic was just like a spur of the moment. This is the way I'm going to characterize the text that I've been given. And you end up taking even Alex by surprise with that. That's a wonderful little nugget there that I don't think that even, like, I learned a lot of Easter eggs and side stuff from Alex along the way, but this is one that I had no clue about. Would you say then that Krieger was always meant to be a secret villain this whole time, and you're the one that brought out that different side of him then? Because honestly, some of the most interesting characters in New Century, I think, are the more complex people, where you can see the through line of why they made the decisions they made, even if we see some of those decisions as being horrific, especially in regards to emotional connections, like having to ostensibly kill someone you love in order to prevent further calamity.
Yeah, because I didn't know the whole arc of where Krieger was going to end up at that point. Mm-hmm. You know, so at the beginning, you know, he seemed more of, not aloof, but slightly, you know, and, you know, it's like, I'm the smartest guy in the room, you know, just listen to what I'm, you know, going with. And sometimes develop some resentment, you know, to a person like that, going, oh, all right, well, great, here they go again, and now I'm just gonna have to listen to them, how much smarter they are than I am, and that I don't get it. And
what's Cyclopean?
But when you find out later, you know, of some of the things that they've been through, someone like that is I think still going to have some emotion in their head of, I've been through, you know, horrible stuff that, you know, nobody else has been through, you know, so I should be hardened to all this, but, you know, there are still times I'm going to be vulnerable. I mean, making a choice and a quote sacrifice unquote like that, you know, is going to be brutal for almost anyone who's not, you know, like sociopathic. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, is he a sociopath? I don't know. You know, now we get into that whole nature versus nurture conversation. You know, it's like, well, you know, what have you got going around you? It's like, wow, the, you know, everything sucks here and we're all dying, you know, so, you know, I'm going to, you know, make that choice to, you know, preserve myself in any way, shape or form that I can, you know, and then you start, you know, getting into some, you know, really, you know, heavy stuff of, you know, humanity, but making him sympathetic there, I think it's something I wanted the audience to hold on to going forward when you're like, wait a minute, you just did what? And you said what? You know, and, you know, you could have told us all this stuff from the beginning, but you didn't. But there's that defining moment of Krieger going, I'm still struggling with how, you know, how I did this. Everything else incidental, but this was just awful to him. You know, so that's one of those things where you grasp onto and go, I hate this guy, but
I don't know the right words to describe that, but I think, and of course I want to avoid, the one thing I do want to avoid is talking about how Uncivil Outlaw ends up, because it's already been heavily alluded that Krieger and Greta are out there somewhere, and Abigail and James are chasing them around, and will likely eventually have a confrontation with them. But because we haven't gotten to that point, I'm just going to work with the characterization that we've had of him up till that point.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you would like to hear us talk about Krieger in regards to what we learn in Uncivil Outlaw, there are 3 whole Q&A sessions with Alex and Sharon available on the New Century Podbean channel that will be coming out over the next few weeks. Obviously, it's not going to be as in-depth as we get into during a normal episode of Through the Wind Door, in part because there's a lot to discuss about Uncivil Outlaw as a whole. But being a fan podcast that is encouraged to consider the author stone cold dead when we have our conversations, we want to save most of our discussion and speculation for said podcast. It's just that at this rate, it's likely our Uncivil Outlaw episode is going to be 6 months or more away. So this is something that we'll tide you over in the meantime. And I'll put a link in the doobly-doo, just in case you might not be following that stream or be a fan on Patreon.
Krieger encapsulates, like, he's a little bit of Hammond from Jurassic Park, where he assumes that because he is the smartest person in the room, that he has control over these vast powers or knowledge that he's gathered along the way. And yet, even though he's proven time and time again that that's not true, he still assumes that because he is the smartest person, that he is the one that can fix it. And
right.
So therefore, the stuff that's going on, like, these are stories that he is trying to tell himself. This is the narrative that he has shaped for himself in order to prevent him from viewing himself as the villain.
Yeah.
But the real dangerous aspect in there is that, like, say, Joel from The Last of Us, the villainous aspect is that he himself has taken peremptory action and not taken anybody else's opinions or feelings into consideration.
Yeah.
The danger is in assuming himself being superior, even if it's just internally and not megalomaniacal. He has appointed himself judge and jury and executioner, and that's what makes him dangerous.
Very much so.
And he's so closed off that there's no one else, so he never seeks anyone else out to see, okay, I'm confronted with this problem, what solutions may we find? It's just, nope, I'm the only person in my world who knows this, so I've got to make this decision, so there we go.
And it doesn't even consider to him that be like, oh, it's fine, I've found James, so he's a person of a like mind that can I'm going to go off and save my own ass. He can figure it out from here. But he's not a fucking Xanatos because he didn't even consider something straightforward like, oh, what if the house burns down and all of my information is lost? You know,
I was away for 5 minutes. How did this happen?
As Frau might say, this conversation is somewhat exaggeration for comic effect. But the ideas that we ran over the top of very quickly are all things that we discussed more seriously in the episode where these events happened, and are still relevant points. We're just sort of being carried away by the moment.
Let's move on to something. We're having a lot of fun here. I'm not saying to say that any of it has not been entertaining as we get into serious subjects. But here's a bigger curiosity that I have. Tiger's Eye.
Here we go.
Well, the characters that you play in that are primarily all supporting roles.
Yes.
Whether it's the the seneschal of the tribe that's being run by the little girl, Garrick, or Marwa. I don't even know if that's how you pronounce his name. One of the
Mar.
Mar. Okay. It's spelled M-A-R-W. Oh, okay. It was just spelled.
That might be a typo for me. I have no
idea. Okay, fair enough. Yeah. You're also heavily involved in the furry community.
Yep.
I've been very furry adjacent, so I know some of that, what that involves.
Furry adjacent. That's great.
I spent most of my 20s on mushes of some stripe. Stripe. The first mush that I was on was role play for Transformers, but I quickly segued on from there to one of the larger ones from there, Furry Muck. And I've had a number of personas over the years, and it's kind of obvious from my Twitter handle, I identify most with being a canine. But I'd never actually been to a furry convention or even seen someone wearing a full-on fursuit or anything like that. I just, you know, I was following certain artists, and a lot of my ongoing online friends were people that I had met as a result of being on Furry Muck and everything like that.
Sure.
So, honestly, it feels like I went a long way to suggest that I'm not a furry, because I wasn't as deep into that subculture as some are. But listening to myself talk, that feels like I'm being disingenuous. There was a certain amount of stigma attached to being a furry back in the day that is not as much now, and I guess I still carry a little of that around with me. But if I can accept my bisexuality with all its caveats, then I should be able to accept that part of my life as well. In my house, my friends call me Doge. It's who I am, and I shouldn't be ashamed even a little. But let's get back to the topic.
I'm kind of curious if your experience as being part of that community contributed at all towards your ability to inhabit different characters, but in particular, if certain animal mannerisms, which you'd be more familiar with, were in any way a resource for Alex as he started writing a story where all of the main characters are non-human?
The first part, definitely, I would say character development, you know, can come from that arena. So my main character is a ferret,
mm-hmm.
which, after you get to talk to me, it's like, okay, this guy's bouncy. He's kind of off the wall a little bit here and there. He's definitely got a mischievous. Definitely got a mischievous streak. You know, not malicious, but you know, sometimes he likes being a goofball and kind of a pain in the ass just for the sake of being a pain in the ass. And then you go, wow, that really is a ferret. So it's like, well, that's perfect. But each of them generally. Well, at least for me, you know, and I won't, you know, speak for other ones out there, but in general, you know, fursonas kind of have their, you know, 2, 3, 4 characteristics that really define them. So Scrapper, the ferret, is exactly that. He's definitely the kind to put his hands on his hips and go, yeah, I said it, you know, or, you know, you know, it's like, oh, there's something shiny over there that can come with me. That's fine. You know, if you're familiar with, have you ever heard of the program Telegram, the instant messaging program Telegram?
No, that's no one on me.
Telegram, oh, it's fantastic. It allows you, think of it like an instant messaging program that you can, you know, have group chats, you can have, you know, one-on-one chats, and there's a lot of customization with it that you can pull in GIFs, send GIFs back and forth, and they also have what are called stickers. Stickers are basically just drawings that, you know, people make and can, you know, send back and forth to each other. So a lot of the furry, Telegram is huge with furry.
Okay.
I have my own sticker pack, which an artist friend, he does for me, you know, a lot of these. And a lot of the stickers are really developed around my personality, and he knows me well. He knows my expressions, and one of the stickers is Scrapper the ferret sitting there with his arms crossed, saying, "Yeah, I said it." You know, others are, you know, like him looking down, going, "Well, that's a thing," and so that just happened. You know, things like that. And I have actually two versions of Scrapper's suit, and the first one has a moving jaw, which allows a lot more emoting in that regard. So there'll be times, you know, I've, you know, walked up to people, you know, at Anthrocon, which is in Pittsburgh where I live, you know, people who are outside and eating, they'll say, you know, Pittsburgh got to be a very furry friendly town. So, you know, people be like, "Oh my gosh, hey, how are you doing?" And I, you know, just kind of, you know, walk up to them, put my arm on their shoulder and sit next to them and, you know, and just look at their, you know, plate and the jaw starts moving, going, "Well, you're going to eat that?" And they're like, "Oh, hey, wait a minute." You know, it's like, you know,
okay, that's gone to another level.
You know, exactly. Like, whoa, I didn't expect that coming, you know. So for Scrapper, yeah, that's definitely going, all right, I'm going to take these 3 or 4, you know, my partner had made a Lucario suit for me. If you're familiar with the world of Pokemon, ooh. I had a Lucario suit, and that character was definitely more a little gruff, a little, you know, standoffish, you know, a little grousey, you know, except, you know, he was very willing to be kind to kids or anything like that. If any of them ever wanted to hug him, you know, high five, here's a hug, go on your merry way. Things like that. So he was kind of like the gruff old man who had a soft heart, you know, but didn't want anybody to know about it. You know, so when you take those kind of things and envelop them into the characters, it really allows you to, again, bring that forth and say, all right, this is my character who's really along these lines, and allow that to come forward and go, all right, this one needs to be caring, this one needs to be, you know, nonchalant, this one needs to be kind of a jerk, this one needs to be strict. And the biggest instance I've got in that now, are either of you familiar with Magic the Gathering?
Oh yes, very familiar.
Okay. One of my biggest costumes, I have in a Johnny Goldmane costume.
Oh god, that would be brilliant. Okay.
If you have your phone handy on you, if you look up Jackal costuming, all one word, as a Twitter handle, you can see the Johnny costume, you know, in pretty short order.
Explaining Magic the Gathering would take way too much time here, but just so people aren't too lost, a Johnny Goldmane and Jace the Mind Mage are two of the heroic characters that are often referenced as a part of the overarching story of that card game. There's a number of pieces of tie-in fiction that reference them, but originally the characters were simply represented by very powerful cards that would allow you to summon them as allies, or alternately were name-dropped in other collectible cards in the set.
But a Johnny is... You know, I love Jace because, you know, there was a lot of personal connections to Jace, but Johnny really has kind of become my favorite planeswalker, because at first he was very hot-headed, out for vengeance for his brother, and just like, you know, just single-mindedly, this is what I'm going after, but has...
This is a really good Jace.
Oh, thank you. become more of, as people call him, Cat Dad, because... That's what he is now. He's a mentor. He's a leader. He's kind of, you know, more quiet when he needs to think about things, you know, before he needs to get into a fight or anything like that. And so those qualities are really something that you kind of bring into when you're doing a fursuit is exacerbating or again, elaborating and enhancing those qualities to bring that out to really represent that character and what it's doing. Because yes, there are some furries that still do not talk in suit. Me, I can't shut the hell up. So that's not an option for me.
Yeah.
I can see why the moving jaw would be handy for that.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something one of my suits does not have a moving jaw, and that one's a little tough for me to still work with right now. And I'm like, people can't see what I'm doing. But the way that translating that into everyone in, you know, Tiger's Eye, it's kind of the same thing. It's the same as any character. It's just, they just happen to have fur.
I think I may have to put some of these links into the show notes when this eventually goes up, because I found the Ajani costume, and oh my God, that enormous double-bladed axe.
I made the axe. Jin made the suit. I made the axe and the armor.
Awesome. It's well done. Yes, absolutely.
What I love about all of this is that the community is so, it's very reflective, and a lot of the time you go through life, you sort of see yourself as kind of a amorphous slate that's kind of, you're sort of acquiring a lot of different habits, and maybe with some people you're like this and with other people you're like that, and you can lose yourself a little bit. And to take some of your best elements, or not even just only the best elements, but the things that you know are part of yourself but are part of a greater whole that you strive towards.
Yeah.
I think there's a real meditative quality to that, which is just so essential.
Yeah, it's a definitely still thoroughly misunderstood fandom, I would say. Furries? Oh my goodness gracious.
Thoroughly.
I didn't catch that, sorry. And there is still a lot of stigma that comes with it. You know, and some people will never understand, and honestly, that's okay. That's perfectly okay. You know, it's just when it starts getting into the, I'd say, misrepresenting, you know, people who are in it, or automatically disqualifying you from, you know, being friends with them because, you know, you're part of that fandom. I mean, for the longest time, my work was completely oblivious that I'm in the community, and still I don't think a ton of people know, but there are some that do know. You know, they flat out know, yes, I make these costumes, yes, I go to the conventions, yes, I have fun at them. But it's something that, you know, some people just, you know, are patently out and happy about it, and some people not so much, because, you know, the corporate world is, you know, it's tenuous, I'd say, at best. You know, sometimes, you know, revealing something that's out of the ordinary, you know, so you kind of got to be, you know, careful and pick and choose your spots as to, you know, who you tell, honestly.
Some things that people might not say, but everyone just sort of knows, is that above and beyond the parts of ourselves that we may not share with others because we're worried about they're being generally accepted by people. You were talking about your experience recently about people at work telling you to not wear your heart on your sleeve. We all end up having to wear masks as a result of just interacting with the world.
Oh, absolutely.
And you present one facet to your work environment, you present one facet to your parents, you present one facet to your close friends, and then there's an internal self that may include things that nobody necessarily knows about you.
Exactly.
And if you work in customer service, then oh my God, that's another completely separate mask that most people, when they look at you as being a service provider, don't even necessarily understand that there may be a life for yourself that doesn't involve doing stuff for them 24/7. Right. So Yeah.
I'm not the post in an RPG. Like, I'm not just here to sell you stuff. I go home at the end of this. I am like, wait, have you seriously never done this yourself? What is wrong with it? Just a whole process.
Yeah. Yeah. And people, for me, especially because I'm definitely different of a personality for what my job is. If you're familiar with Myers-Briggs at all, I am an ENFP-T. So, you know, extremely extroverted. I feel things. I perceive things, you know, and the dash T is more turbulent. So, you know, there are times, you know, I'll be a little bit more, you know, scattered and bouncing from thing to thing. But what I do for my daily job is I'm in programming. I'm in internal controls and testing things, and you know, I'm going back for my degree in data analytics because my undergraduate degrees are in geography and psychology. You know, so when I got those degrees, I was unemployed, obviously. you know, so I kind of happened into the career path that I am in because I could comprehend math. I can comprehend databases and all that stuff. And then people go, "Oh, so what do you do in your spare time? Do you do that?" I'm like, "No, I listen to this. I play, I used to play these instruments. I paint, I do all this creative work." And they're going, "But your job is this, isn't?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm completely the wrong personality for this job." So that allows me that, I don't want to say escapism as such. It's to me, again, enhancement of who I am, because people go, "Well, why would you want to identify with an animal? I mean, isn't that a little weird?" And you're like, "No, because people who go to anime conventions like to associate with other characters, and people, there are other people who are be like, I'm perfectly fine with, who I am exactly." And it's like, that's great. It's not that I'm dissatisfied with who I am. I can just go out and have fun. It's like, "Well, why don't you design other human characters?" It's like, why?
Why should I have to?
Yeah, why should I have to? It's like, okay, I just, want to, give this, different patterns. And I just want to be goofy,
literally goofy, because
I've seen people do it.
Yeah.
Any form of role playing is room to express yourself, and when you have the capacity for any imaginative creation throughout all of sci-fi and fantasy, why would you want to? It's like saying, "Well, why don't you only watch rom-coms and dramatic movies like The Departed and stuff like that? Why would you enjoy?"
Sounds awful. And like, that's not a dig at rom-coms or the. It's just one genre. No.
Yeah.
Greg, how would we ever be fans of New Century if we were fans of just one genre?
Yeah, exactly. That's the anathema of this sort of thing.
Yeah,
exactly.
And something that I read that just blew my mind lately, and how did I miss this? The Matrix is one of my favorite movies ever. Mm-hmm. I love it. Mm-hmm. And one thing I was not aware of, that I read is the character Switch was supposed to be a different gender depending on where they were. So in one world, Switch was a man, in the other, Switch was a woman. I'm like, that's brilliant, because again, a lot of us don't allow ourselves that freedom to explore it. And I was like, whoa, how did I not see that one, coming? Mm-hmm. And stuff like that is just, fascinating to me. And honestly, it's just to go and have fun. It's kind of a bummer that some people don't appreciate that. I'm not going to say not appreciate it. They don't have to appreciate it. Mm. I would just rather, if it's not for you, cool. It's not for you. And that's, I'm completely all right with that. 'Cause wearing, you know, like I've worn a Johnny, you know, to some magic events, you know, because they asked me to. I've, you know, worn Lucario a couple, you know, a few conventions, and every now and then you'll get the snide comment or the derogatory comment. You know, it's like, oh, fur fag, you know, things like that. And it's okay. I'm not going to say it's okay. You know, I mean, it generally rolls off our, you know, our backs now, you know, for the most part. But I mean, the funny thing is people don't think that you can hear in that thing. So there was one time I was walking past you know, someone's like, oh, look at this furry faggot. And I just turned and looked at him. I pointed to my ears like, I can hear you. And then like, like, yeah. You know, and
I don't want to go too deep down the rabbit hole, yeah. But when people talk about, like, what happened to geek fandom? It used to be the place of acceptance where everyone was, you know, but yeah, and I'm just thinking to myself, what world were you living on? Geek fandom has been stratified since the beginning.
Oh, and yeah.
It's only more obvious now after things like Gamergate and shit like that.
Yeah.
So.
It's just like, you know that as time goes on, things should be more complicated because we're getting a more, like, nuanced understanding of things. And it's like, it wasn't simpler back then. You just weren't questioning this shit because sometimes you benefited from it. And that's part of life. There are all sorts of systems that you're a part of. And oh my goodness, I'm going off on a tangent. But
we ragged on Nickelback because that's what you were supposed to do. You're supposed to rag on Nickelback.
And we owe it to Deadpool for setting us straight.
I used to say as a kid, we make fun of Massachusetts because we can, but we make fun of New Jersey because we should. I'm sorry, anyone from Massachusetts or New Jersey.
Look. As someone that has lived in Massachusetts all my life, I completely understand and accept that we are massholes. That's just who we are. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to make you joke.
I took a sip of iced tea and it just went down the wrong way at the wrong time. Okay, sorry about that.
It's okay.
Okay,
I thought that I'd accidentally killed you by...
No,
that I was from Massachusetts.
No. What, just out of sheer curiosity, what part? You're going to say Worcester, aren't you?
No, I...
well, not I, now I am.
I am not Bob Chipman. I have no noticeable Bostonian accent.
Oh, okay.
As I said, I've lived in the state my entire life, but my parents moved around so much, and it was primarily in more affluent suburbs of Greater Boston, Watertown, Cambridge, Somerville.
Okay.
Sometimes I would go as far west as, say, like Acton or Maynard when my father was living with friends out there. But yeah, if you want a deep Boston accent, you tend to have to go either North Shore, South Shore,
Southeast.
Like, yeah, exactly. Or deep in the, like, the north end of Boston or something like that.
Gotcha. Okay, and I do know it's pronounced Quincy, so.
Yeah, well, I could go over with you all the different ways that we pronounce things differently out here, but we don't have that kind of time.
Yeah. I still think my favorite thing from New England is, oh, you can't get there from here.
Yeah. Well, you can.
You don't want to go down that road.
We don't have signposts here. It, honestly, GPS was one of the best things that could ever be invented for Bostonians because you've probably seen the meme of, you know, an above picture of New York, and it'd be like, New York, because we'd like you to know where you're going and how to get there.
Yeah.
And then a picture of from above of Boston with all its curved streets and weird cul-de-sacs and just all over the place. And the caption is, Boston, because fuck you.
Yep, yep, exactly. Oh, my.
So this may have been briefly answered, but I'm interested in hearing a more elaborate response to it. Was there any particular role that you found to be most out? So you have a huge range. Is there one that was outside of that range, or you had a specific problem with because of the accent that Alex was asking you to do?
Oddly enough, Krieger and, oh my gosh, the other
Kaufman.
Every now and then really gave me fits because sometimes it would inadvertently start sounding Russian. And I'm like, what the fuck is going on here? It's like, yeah, and I'm like, that makes no damn sense.
I have a theory, which is that it is the pitfall that everyone will run into as soon as they try to do an accent. Russian accent is where all accents will eventually devolve into. It just naturally goes there. Doesn't matter if you were trying to do Scottish, French, like German. It does not matter. Russia's where you're heading.
Oh, God. Oh, man. There Russia's were a couple where times.
Russian too?
Yeah, yeah. I think Alex asked me to try and do some Scottish and Irish accents, which is really friggin' bizarre because my father's side of the family, my grandmother is from Glasgow, my grandfather was from Manchester, and to hell if I could do anything, you know, even remotely close, you know, I mean, you know, the closest I got, you was watching Archer the time he's dealing with the Irish mob, you know, it's like, you know, it's like, you know, it's like, no son, you're gonna die, you know, it's like, and I'm like, okay, you know, great, you know, if it's not Scottish, it's crap, you know, it's like, I didn't care about that, you know, and Alex is like, that's fucking terrible. I'm like, I know, he asked me to do a Cockney accent, what? One time.
Oh no.
And he's like, maybe we'll just make that one more American. I was like, thank you, because what the hell?
Had he not seen Mary Poppins? Jim Jiminy.
Yeah, I had, and every now and then my brain just goes friggin' haywire and I just mess them up. So I kind of work. The funny thing is, I had started getting better at an Irish accent. When I was commuting to work still, yeah, I've been working at home since March. If I was driving in, there was one religious channel and the person that was delivering the sermons was Irish. So I just started repeating back what he was saying, you know, and I was like, and as I was skimming, I'm like, yeah, this, all right, well, I can do this. And, you know, and then, you know,
people repeating the good word.
Yeah, 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 you know, oh, father, you know, it's like, oh, God, you know, and just some of these things in the way that he would say them and just coming off the tongue like that. And I was like, oh, God, I'm still terrible at it, you know. But yeah, oh, the Cockney accent. Oh, geez. Ask Alex about that sometime. He's just going to go, oh, ooh, yeah.
Yeah. This was a mistake.
Yeah.
I made a huge mistake.
Yeah. That was definitely in the mistake category.
The section of conversation just after this, I just scrapped due to noise pollution and the fact that it covers a story that we've already told multiple times about how Toby and I came together to do Through the Wind Door. One of the things we finished with was commenting on how great creative works inspire others to be creative. And Matt had this to say in response.
It still blows my mind that there are people who you know, appreciate the voices that I've done. It's something I'm not used to in that regards. And yeah, I would definitely love to do more of it, and you know, it just allows me to get stuff out there that I like being an entertainer. I like making people, you know, happy or you know, felt like the time that they spent immersed or indulging in certain, you know, aspects was definitely worth their time to do it, because a voice to me is so, well, it's personal, it's unique. And, you know, if someone were to hear that and go, oh, hey, I know that voice, that was really neat. And that was really cool. I think people throw the word humbling around a lot, and I don't want it to lose its gravitas, as it were. But for someone to say that they've enjoyed what I did and that they really connected with a character, really, to me, it is humbling, and it's wild that someone would take that much interest in what I've done. Kind of like the same thing. One time, I was in one of my Jace cosplays, and someone asked me to sign their card, and I looked at them, you know, kind of bewildered, you know, because in the grand scheme of the Magic cosplay world, there are people who know who I am, but I'm not as well known as some of the others, and I looked at them, I'm like, Do you want me to sign it like with my actual name, or do you want me to sign it? Jeez, I had no idea. I had no clue what I'm supposed to do in that situation. And that just threw me for a loop. I did not definitely deer in the headlights look going, okay. So, you know, and they had they handed me a Sharpie and everything. I was like, damn, that's wild. You know, and if someone were to go, oh, hey, you know, I got to talk to the guy who does Oberon. I'd be like, I'm just me. I'm just a dude. You know, just a guy who runs around in a ferret suit half the time. You know,
I'm suddenly just picturing Oberon going, what do you want from me?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, Oberon. You want me to sign it? Oberon. You know?
It's like, oh, my Oberon, could you sign this? Why?
Stamp, you know, punches it. There you go. You know, fine, I signed it. You know, like, give me smash my hand in ink. Bam, there you go. Right. Yeah.
That reminds me of a moment in it was like Spider-Man or something like that, where there was someone that gave Peter a specific problem in like bureaucracy or something like that, that was making it very difficult for him in his civilian life. And then later on, he inadvertently rescues her from some kind of calamity that's going on. And she's suddenly like, oh my God, I'm your biggest fan. Would you give me an autograph? And he just sort of looks at her through his mask. And when we next see him swinging off, he's apparently signed a piece of the vent complex on top of the roof that she left her on, and she's like, "Wait, what?" She's like, "If you could get it, if you can take it with you, it's yours."
But yeah, it's. I'm just happy and lucky to be involved.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly.
We're also happy and lucky that you are involved, and the characters you've brought to life have, as you say, they've entertained and they've resonated and
they've struck an emotional. They've made us laugh and
made us cry. Yeah, like, can't put it any more directly than that.
Yeah,
I really hope to do a more just a straight out comedic character.
Mm.
If there ever is room for one.
Just, I mean, Edison does make me laugh.
Oh, yeah, Edison. Oh, man. I really do enjoy him.
I'm the most entertaining capitalist you'll ever meet.
Yeah. It's, this is mine. You know, it's like, mine, down. Kind of like Daffy Duck.
Oh, God. Yes.
I'm a happy miser. You know.
Tesla is just droopy dog.
I would love to be able to do kind of like an everyday conversation with Tesla and Edison. That's just like in the background, you know, kind of like its own secret rooms in a way. That's just him and I actually doing it live, you know, well, not live, but you know, in real time with each other. Because there are a couple times. I mean, even out of the character as he's doing Tesla, and I'm listening to Edison. I'm like, sometimes I just want to fucking strangle you. You know that?
Arguing over breakfast, the original Odd Couple.
Oh my God. Oh my god, that would be fantastic.
I see a spinoff.
How has he not done this? Alex, do this. Holy shit.
Look, we've come up with like at least a couple dozen ideas for spin-offs over the months we've been doing this and the interviews. If we ever see one of them go, we're taking full credit.
Yeah, exactly.
Justifiably, that's fucking brilliant. I'd pay to watch that.
You'll be in it.
I'd still pay to watch it.
I'm sure Edison would be very happy about that.
Yeah, exactly. Oh my gosh. Alex, get on that. Oh. Get suits.
Well, I do eventually have a pumpkin time, and I have at least a couple of questions that I'd like to get off our plate before we keep you back to the world. And some of this is going to be covering a little bit things that came up during the original roundtables. But unfortunately, those little pieces of new century history are not necessarily available to everyone everywhere. And right. I have maybe the audience will grow. And the thing that I hope is that it will become more accessible. I've made it accessible to new readers, and they will have never had a chance to hear any of this. So going forward, are there characters that you have played over the course of New Century that you're particularly interested in having meet that haven't met already, unlike Tesla and Edison, and have, you know, bits with them or conversations with them, or even just watching them bounce off each other?
Oh, wow. I'd say you could have Oberon with just about anybody.
Yeah.
But I think Oberon's kind of obvious.
Yeah.
Doesn't make it bad, though.
No. So I'm a little rusty on some of my history because I may have Jeremy and Mortimer could be interesting.
Look, Alex, it's not my fault this time. We do eventually talk about it, but Matt invoked the I word, so he's the one that gets to peel potatoes.
Let's see. Honestly, Krieger and Oberon could be really trippy.
That would be a heavy conversation.
That's some really heavy stuff going on in terms of, you know, some of the very, very stark similarities that they have in their life, as well as the differences. Yeah, so if you're looking at them in terms of alignments, you know, is Oberon, you know, kind of like, you know, chaotic good, and is, you know, Krieger more, you know, lawful evil? You know, you look at it, it's like, oh, geez, that could be some really, you know, messed up stuff, especially, like you said, where they have the common ground. Yeah.
I can imagine what, like, if Jeremy met Oberon would very likely think, okay, you have a lot of questions, kid, but I appreciate your energy. I'll humor you to a point.
Yes.
But if Oberon met Krieger, and Krieger went off on one of his expressions to be like, oh, this is very interesting in terms of what it means for the overall, and Oberon is just sort of staring at him as Krieger is sort of like talking to himself and not really at Oberon at
yes,
all.
Absolutely.
And he's just staring at him going like, you realize I'm standing right here, right?
Yep.
I'm a person, not just some sort of concept in your philosopher's sphere.
Yeah.
Just as, like, he's talking about, you know, I would have opened many boxes and think of, like, the, like, creating these pathways to different worlds. And it's like, yep, that sure has worked out real well, hasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Oberon definitely, in terms of his practicality, be like, okay, great. But what's that going to do about right now? That's not going to help much there, buddy. Professor.
Okay, you open these boxes. Who's cleaning it up?
Yeah, exactly. Because it sure as hell isn't going to be me. or Marge Simpson, I'll do it. I always end up doing it. You know,
it's like, and I don't want it to be, but Robin will.
Yeah.
But you bring up Jeremy and Mortimer, and all I can think of, unfortunately, is that, you know, he would probably definitely have questions about all of her gadgets and maybe even be, you know, into her whole fashion aesthetic. And meanwhile, Mortimer would just be looking at Jeremy's exuberance and going, a new toy to play with here.
Yes, very much so.
Don't be mean.
Yeah.
She's still learning how to not be mean.
I mean, Jeremy is our precious cinnamon bun, so, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, in some way, I think he would always be trying to measure up to her intellectually.
Mm.
And still fighting back that, well, we know what happens if I ask too many questions, you know? It's like, oh, God, you know?
I feel like Jeremy is like, okay, how many questions will you be comfortable with me asking? And she'll say, like, 7. And it's like, can I bump it up to 8?
It's like, either that or you'll know when I tell you. It's like,
I like those odds.
You're telling me there's a chance.
I mean, we've already kind of established now at this point just how much of your own emotional range you tend to put into your characters. Mm. I find myself wondering, you know, if you... Well, the question that we've put to other people is if you could talk to one of your characters to either receive advice from them or give advice to them, is there one that specifically stands out to you as someone that you or they would most benefit from that kind of exchange?
Ooh. All right, this is going to get kind of dark and slightly heavy. It would be Francisco, actually.
Wow. Okay, now I definitely want to hear this answer. Okay.
So make of this what you will. Part of the reason why Francisco was also very difficult for me, my father's blood had my father's alcohol had a blood content level.
Ah.
And there are, I would say, a lot of things that I carried forward in life with me because of that.
Mm.
And seeing how different my dynamic is with my son as opposed to his dynamic with me, and how a lot of that, you know, played out and shaped some things that I did or did not do, you know, in life because of his behaviors and actions and things that, you know, forced me to deal with, is really something that kind of wish you could be like, you know, I get what you're going with here, but seeing how someone who's lived through, you know, don't get me wrong, my dad wasn't that bad, but it's a parallel which, you know, I see some issues with, and how much you really affect someone else that's that close into your circle.
Mm-hmm.
And trying not to, you know, get into that point of, well, you know, hey, you got through it and you're a better person for it. It's like, am I? You know, was I? You know,
did I have to go through that?
Yeah, did I? You know, I mean, obviously you can get down to that point of, well, you know, if that didn't happen, then this wouldn't happen. Now you get into that whole butterfly effect nonsense, but you're like, yeah, but at the point you're at right now, you are able to change what's going forward, you know, which, you know, is something that in Miguel's position or, you know, in my position or whatnot, you kind of had to, it's like, all right, well, I'm going to have to adapt and adjust here, you know, and do something different and, you know, sometimes you grow up, you know, a little faster than you would have liked to. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think I definitely emphasize to my kids, like, look, you know, you're here to enjoy, you know, the time that you have as a kid. You know, there are definitely things you have to learn in terms of responsibility. There are things you have to learn in terms of this, but you know, in terms of now, yeah, here you go. Here's something that you're just going to be like, wow, this is fucked up. I would say, because I see my son about half of the week, half the week he's at his mom's, half the week he's here. And, like I said, mom and I are still good friends, but, you know, in like the terms of 3 or 4 days that my son is here, I have more physical contact with my son, whether it's, you know, high fives or hugs or, you know, anything like that. In 3 or 4 days, I have more physical contact with my son than I can honestly remember in my entire lifetime with my dad. You know, and you look at that, it's like, wow, that's really different. You know, getting someone to realize that there is more, you know, going on than just what's in their circle and what they have to do to, quote, protect themselves. You know what? Maybe you can make a change and do things for the better and still take care of yourself. You know, I don't think you're expecting that kind of like, well, that was heavy, dude. But
we're here for it.
That was the first thing that came to my mind. And again, I'm not one to hide my emotions when it comes to something like that. So if you've got someone in your life or there's, you know, something that you think you can improve on and do better, you know, it's never too late to try. You know, they might not be receptive. They might tell you to fuck off, you know, and if that's the case, you know, that's the case. But we've all got things in our past in one way, shape, or form going, I wish I wouldn't have done that. So there's no reason to not change some of those behaviors and whatnot going forward. You know, that's just my pie in the sky idealism that I have now and then. So, you know, take that for what you will. But yeah, that's first thing that comes to mind.
My parents divorced when I was 5 years old. And so I definitely had the experience of being shared by two parents, which would sometimes be the half a week thing and would sometimes be a more complicated experience where I'd be like, okay, I'll be here with them for a few months and here with them for a few months. And because they always also lived in the same area, that affected what schools that I would go to and what lifestyles I would be experienced with. And I would never say that my parents were bad people, but it's definitely affected my own experience in terms of my decision early on that I would never choose to become a parent myself. Because if there's one thing that I took away from my life growing up in a divided home, it's that even when you have parents that are doing their best to love you and give you the best advice possible, that you can never completely protect them from your own idiosyncrasies, from your own insecurities. And my parents did their best, and who I am now is not their fault, but I internalized aspects from all of that growing up that have made it difficult for me in certain ways. And some of that I accept as being contributions towards a kind of person that I would rather be. And there are other things like I can't enjoy holidays anymore because all I can think about is the two of them fighting over who gets me when.
Right.
It's the kind of stuff that results without it being anybody's fault. Mm-hmm. And that's under the best of circumstances. When you have someone that isn't attempting to even try to Like when you have someone that is just being themselves around their child without any additional considerations, then that can have heartbreaking ramifications as a result.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, that was probably, you know, one of the hardest decisions I ever had to make. You know, and my son and I, we actually talk about, you know, a lot of philosophical stuff, you know, especially, you know, coming from that background. And he looks and he goes, you know, I see why you and mom didn't need to stay married. You know, it's like, you know, I love you both and, you know, you're both extremely good to me, but nice. I see it, you know, but again, you know, I think I'm lucky in the fact that I think I've got about, like you said, about the best circumstances I can have. And, you know, you're going to go, wow, this is crazy. Someone's actually talking about how much they appreciate their ex-wife, you know, there are times I've met her friends, you know, they're like, oh, I've heard so much good stuff about you and whatnot. And like, wish my ex-husband was like that. You know, it's like, oh, okay. That's an interesting way to start the conversation. Nice to meet you. You know,
thanks for oversharing there.
Yeah. You know, I mean, even as still, I'm sure, you know, and it's hard because like then in your head, you're like, well, how much worse would it have been if like we'd stayed together and, you know, you watch, oh, they're great. They're fighting again about this stupid thing or this stupid thing. And, you know, and like you said, you always have that rumble of guilt in the background going, oh, I could have done this or I could have done this. But then again, you know, there's the other side of the coin. Like, well, if I didn't do that, then I can't do this. And if I did do that, you know, and then yes, you have to learn to, you know, kind of shut that voice off every now and then and go, just do the best you can.
Yeah. There's the past is always a quagmire of like possibilities and alternative potentials. And
yeah,
there comes a point where you sort of look at things and you go, I can't affect any of that. I can question it. And it's important to do that because then you like you risk making the same mistakes over again. But
yeah,
at some point you realize that the thing that you have the most influence on is what you do right now. And it's the sort of thing that, like, you know, we're all going to make our own mistakes and we're all going to make some improvements on what we learned from other people. But it's the thing that I think what a lot of people have been struggling with, I know I have this year and in other years, is that feeling of confronting just day-to-day life and the world and being like, how can I do anything? Like, what can I even do?
Yeah.
And it's the sort of thing where you can't know anything for certain, but you know that it will only happen when you do something about it, and that you can take that time and you can like mend yourself, and you do need to do that, but there will be that time where you know that the past doesn't, like, it has shaped you, but it doesn't determine what you do next.
Yeah, and something that I picked up from my brother, and I can't remember where he picked it up. It's a little tough in 2020 specifically, just because of all the, you know, crazy stuff that's going on. But something that I've been trying to employ in my life and impart on my son. Yeah, because, you know, with the ADHD, there's also a little bit of anxiety and whatnot. It is a really strange statement, but don't borrow worry from a future that doesn't exist. Because, you know, it's not there. You know, we don't know, you know, what things that we're going to, you know, deal with. Sure, you can be cautious. You can be, you know, you can have foresight. You can do anything like that. But worrying about that and borrowing that in the present is just, you know, it does very little good for you personally, you know, and like I said, difference between planning and being prepared and just, you know, looking at every possible outcome and, you know, going all Doctor Strange and going, well, there's one possible outcome. Like, you know what? Wherever we go, we go. You know, it's like, and whatever we can do to change and shape things, you know, let's do that. So,
I mean,
And it's even very topical because these are the very first words of Annie Oakley in Secret Rooms. So, well done.
And, like, I guess what this conversation all boils down to is that one panel of that one awkward zombie comic where Bowser just determines, you know what, fuck everything that Gino is saying. Free will, chumps!
Yeehaw, absolutely.
Well, I have one final question for you then. That every fan or member of the Greater White Scarves gets to have their own identity in the what we've been calling the White Scarvengers. And Loretta obviously took us completely off the rails when she decided to be basically Pinkie Pie.
I knew. I was like, it's going to be Pinkie Pie.
but Pinkie Pie wearing a Batman outfit.
I mean, we probably should have imagined that, like, if any fan podcast series was going to have multi-dimensional team-ups, it was going to be this one.
Yeah. So, keeping in mind that we are no longer leaving ourselves only to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, what avatar would you like to be for our gathering of United Heroes?
You know what? A Johnny Goldman.
Yeah, I knew you were going to say that! I knew it! Done, sir. Done.
This poster's going to be really cool.
Matt, you've been brilliant. I guess I was maybe a little worried about how this was going to turn out. I didn't want to suck up too much of your time. And I guess I was not prepared for just how high energy you were going to be, even based on listening to you talk during the roundtables. So thank you so much for taking 2.5 hours out of your day.
Oh, you're absolutely very welcome.
Share some experiences and thoughts and just all of this stuff with all of us. I'm sure that everyone will enjoy it as much as we do.
I hope so.
It has flown by. This has been such a pleasure.
Thank you so much. I'd be happy to talk with you guys anytime.
Well, we may very well have you back on when we get to Princess Thieves and we have more to talk about some of the elements going on there. And of course, we look forward to any further recurrence of your beloved characters or any new roles that you ask to take on as New Century goes forward. And that brings us to the end of another White Scarves Unite. Tune in next time for finding out how else we're going to completely fuck up the roster of our heroes here. Have a good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
So that's the end of our time with Matt. For now, obviously, we got a lot off topic, but I hope that you found our talking points as funny and engaging as we did, as we seesawed from silly to serious and back to silly again. We're supposed to be a New Century show, but the great thing is that we can always have him back on if we think up new questions to ask. This is coming out in the lead-up to the election, so I was pondering hard about what kind of song to use for the outro. Discussions of fathers and sons made me think of some more serious or thoughtful pieces, but I worried about dragging down the mood further. Therefore, we shall return to the experimental sounds of They Might Be Giants, and present a piece as off-the-wall and as fun as Matt Wardle himself. Join me, all of you, in learning how to build a birdhouse in your soul. Vigilantly. Because of Matt's high energy, our pre-podcast conversation went off on wild tangents, and I decided to save and use a bunch of it in the hopes that it would also be entertaining to you. Here's a clip.
All right, keys have been turned. All good.
Dyna thrusters are up. No, but Dyna thrusters. Crap. I don't even remember.
Greg, shut it down. We'll start again.
The hell's a semi-flange? I hope someone gets that reference.
And this is actually an old geek reference that I didn't get, so I needed Matt to explain.
No, oh my goodness! It's a Thundercats set of outtakes.
Oh,
and you hear Panthro giving, "Keep your damn foot off that blasted Samoflange," and Lionel goes, "What the hell's a Samoflange?" or something like that.
Oh wow! Okay.
God, like I now know where I've heard that before, because like years ago there was this like animated skit, and I forget like who did it, but it was like Thunder Lolcats, and
yes.
I found that hilarious at the time, and it is so dated now, but it's still fun. And at one point, one of the characters says that, and I was like, oh, that's weird. And here I am 10 years later, and I have context. This is why I make friends on the internet.
Yeah, I am from the old original meme generation. Well, I'm hell before that, so, you know.
With the grizzled beards, it's like I used to be with it, but then they changed what it was.
What it was, and now what's it is scary. It'll happen to you. You know, I used to write my college papers, my first 2 years of college papers, on a Commodore 64. That'll tell you something.
Wow.
Yeah.
My first computer was one that you. I'm sorry, I'm not trying to be hipster here, but did you know that Atari made a computer?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right. I used to have an Atari ST.
Yeah,
and that was my first experience with not only, like, video games that were not in an arcade, but also using it was one of the few computers besides Apple that was doing a mouse interface.
Oh, jeez.
So, yeah, exactly.
I'm just going to stay quiet and pretend that I'm not the complete baby in the room.
Homer Simpson nodding politely.
Fades into the grass.
God, you don't even know what it was like when you had to boot your entire operating system off of a floppy disk.
Yeah. Lodestar, *8, 1.
It's such a common joke, but I love it, is that people will see, like, be going through their parents' old stuff and say, hey, Mom, why do you have, like, the save logo as a thing? Like, and it's just like, oh, yeah, no one knows what a floppy disk is except the save logo.
Oh, yeah, my son's 14 now, and talk about it's painful now because I'm at the point where it's like, well, in my day, and I'm like, why don't I just, like, punch myself in the junk? Get it over with, you know.
But what else do you say except in my day? Like, what? Like,
yeah.
When I was a wee lad of exactly. In 1907.
Yeah, we used to use the word dickety.
Lean into it, embrace it.
Exactly. This is going swimmingly.
All right.
We're going completely off the rails here, but it's fine.
First question of the evening. How many floppy disks do you have?
I have a lot.
Oh, dear. Oh, God.
I still have my Commodore.
Oh, dear. It's okay. Loretta's interview went off the rails in a completely different direction because she wouldn't stop making funny voices. So,
oh, that does not. That is completely on brand.
The two things I remember about Thundercats was there was apparently one episode where Lion-O had to prove his worth by fighting all of the other Thundercats without the Sword of Omens. And the other thing is that Panthro apparently didn't know how to pronounce nunchucks. Those are the two things I remember.
Oh, jeez.
Why? Well, like, what did he say? Like,
nunchucks.
Oh, nunchucks. No. Maybe he called it that because they make you numb afterwards.
I mean, I feel like it was. I'm guessing it may have been some sort of anglicization that. But it makes you sound stupid because it's like one word, it's like one letter away. It's not hard to get right. So, anyway.
More like non-chucks.
None of the above, chucks.
Yeah. Vote for none of the above.
I can't tell if we're making a good first impression or a terrible first impression, oh, but
great.
we'll just move ahead then.
That said, not all these outtakes and bloomers were confined to the pre-show conversation. Some of it happened during the podcast proper, and some immediately after because we couldn't stop talking to Matt. Hello again, dear listeners, and welcome to another White Scarves Teen-Up. Great, I've already...
Summer Flange. I was so tempted to just say Summer Flange in the middle of that. I was like, no, I don't want to mess up the take. And then it's like, oh, wait.
It's okay. I'm in the habit of including outtakes at the end of these sessions anyway. So great. We've got our first stinger. Yeah. Okay.
Other facets.
I didn't think it could get more. I could get crazier than Loretta. I was wrong. I was so wrong.
Well, that's the thing about the round tables, is because they get so meta and they get so into theory and they are so knowledgeable about cinema and all that stuff behind it. A lot of the times I'm Homer Simpson nodding politely. I'm like, uh-huh. So that's why I guess I come off really, I would say, more quiet and less animated during those. Cause sometimes a lot of it's just me, you know, when it's like, oh, hey, Matt, I have a question for you. I'm like, okay, cool. I can do that. You know, it's,
ears perk up.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, normally I'm kind of batshit nutters.
to the Wikipedia!
Exactly.
The online encyclopedia anyone can edit.
This podcast is sponsored by Wikipedia.
I kind of want to set it up so that we're interviewing Edison, and Alex has just been keeping quiet the whole time, and then Tesla just butts in at one point, and it's like, how long have you been there? Longer than you would like.
Long enough. Yeah, that would be good.
I've gotten a headache from laughing too much.
This started out special where it's like, oh no, I'm already sore from laughing before we started.
Start as we mean to go on. But let's end on something particularly heartwarming.
Yeah, and Theo is just such... I love Theo. She's great.
Yeah.
And
we've had a lot of fun all together.
Yeah.
Slowly corralling everybody and
getting
the story.
Loretta, Loretta is she is such a trip. She's such a trip. I love her too. I love everybody in the cast. They're all really, really good.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we're pretty lucky. We've got a very cool bunch of people on our interview list.
And it's not only that, but it's like I would say in general, this is true in the fandom as well, but Alex and Sharon tend to attract a very specific kinds of personalities, I would say, that just it makes it so everyone can get on the same page together very well. One of the things Alex talks about is I think this has to do a little bit with his early experience with the Cartographer's Handbook back when he was trying to put it out on YouTube, that he was worried that the text of his books wasn't going to be strong enough on their own, and that's why he wanted to dramatize them out. One of the early things that I talked about was that I am not usually a thing for audiobooks specifically, but audiobooks always tend to have one speaker and trying to do all of the roles. And it's just like, maybe there are people out there that take in input through their ears better than they do reading text on a page. I've never had that problem. I grew up with books. But when you actually have a full cast, like what happened with the dramatic reading of World War Z, which is part of where this impetus originally came from, and when all of you come together and voice various characters in order to add verisimilitude to this world and actually engage us with the emotions and the actions and the feelings of everyone involved, there's more of a remove when you're reading words on a page that allow you to sort of experience things without directly... without them necessarily living inside your head, depending on, you know, how your brain works in recreating or experiencing things. But when it's Maya talking about the death of Beauregard, or when it's just something so heartbreaking, or Spencer doing the Baltus speech, or whatever.
Oh, man.
It just sucks you in, and sometimes you just need to set it down because you need to process whatever just happened. It's just too much for you to carry at that moment, but that adds to the overall strength.
And
we're very happy that you've helped create a larger, more immersive experience for everyone involved. It's honestly, it's blown us away. There wouldn't be a fan podcast if it wasn't for the strength of what everybody was putting out there.
Again, thank you so much for that. That really, that means the world to me. So